Okay, we're back. I'm amazed at how 300 people were able to get lunch in this cafeteria that quickly. We're now on to step three, and I said that the first part of the discussion and how it works is not really about step three, but it's about why we take step three. And I want to talk about that. Included in this discussion is an extremely important definition of a word, because the word that is defined in this part of the big book, the word selfish, is not the way it is found in a dictionary. And it's very, very important when we start to work step four to understand the difference in the definition of the word selfish in the big book as opposed to what it is in the dictionary. I'll show that when we get there. Go to page 60. What do we mean by turning our will and our life over to God as we understand Him? The first requirement, they say, at the bottom of page 60, is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. We're going to be understanding, as we read this portion of the big book, that no matter whether our motives are good or bad, so long as they're our motives, so long as they're things that we want to have happen, that will be contrary to our recovery. That will harm our recovery. The more we want things to happen our way, the more our recovery is threatened. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. And I've got to tell you, one of my dreams is to direct plays. And the other one is to conduct an orchestra. I'm not very good at either one of those, but I would love to be in charge of a group of people whose job it is to create something that I'm in charge of, right? And I expand this to the world. I have always been a person who believes that if his way were adopted, the world would be a better place. And I've got to tell you, it would be a better place. It would be based on a whole bunch of much better things than the world is based on now. Having said that, though, I must admit that my drive to have the world be the way I want it to has been counterproductive. And I remember when my first sponsor pointed out this passage in the big book, and he said, you know, you want to be the director of a play that you're acting in. That is your problem. And it hit me right in the solar plexus. That's exactly true. That's exactly what I have wanted to be, the director of the play. And the big book goes on. It says, if his arrangements would only stay put, if people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. My daughter, if she went to school and enjoyed school, will have a better life later. You know, if the politician didn't say this, it would be better. If they didn't do this, it would be better. If the talk show host didn't speak this way, if people were more cooperative, there weren't torture in the world, all kinds of really virtuous reasons why I want life to be better. I've had a good life, but there are a lot of people who suffer. I don't want people to suffer. If only people didn't suffer in life, you know? And my motives are generally virtuous in that respect. I'm Jewish. I grew up in the 50s. The specter of the Holocaust was on there, and all the education I had, I went to Jewish schools. I was taught by survivors. I mean, you may or may not be able to imagine what that did in my growing up to my feelings about the suffering that humanity has gone through. And I don't mean just Jews. I mean the suffering that humanity has gone through. When the stuff in Darfur and the Sudan happened, I think about it and these are awful, awful things. And I grew up well, but I always have felt a need for the world to be different. And it says, he may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. And my joke, I think, is generally true, that if you had asked anyone other than my family whether these traits applied to me, aside from the modest one, I think most people would have said that I was kind, considerate, patient, generous, and self-sacrificing. My family would have thought something different, but I think a lot of people would have thought that. You know the joke, I used to be conceited, but I got over that, now I'm perfect. Then they say, on the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. And certainly I have been like that too. I've wanted applause. I've wanted people to like me. I've wanted things to happen for my benefit, to make more money or to be given more recognition or to be the center of attention. God knows I've wanted that. I've wanted to be right, you know, in arguments. I've wanted to be to get A's in schools, in courses. I've wanted my daughters not to bug me. I've wanted to be able to be in peace and not to have people talk to me all the time. I've wanted to have a huge source of income without having to work for it. I mean, these are all not quite so virtuous motives that I've had. I've wanted to have relationships with women less for having a good relationship and more for what they make me feel like. I had one girlfriend who was really quite beautiful, and when I look back at my relationship with her, much of it was, well, she made me feel handsome or worthwhile in some way. She validated my existence. She validated my attractiveness. And I'm not even sure I even wanted a relationship with her other than that having her on my arm made me feel as if the world treated me better. Frankly, it did. She was beautiful, and they did treat me better. But that is a lousy reason to have a relationship with anyone. As a matter of fact, it was a relatively destructive relationship. And certainly exploitative. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. And that's true. I mean, when my daughter was 12, 13 years old, and she was going through, a disassociative phase, where she was marking her distance between my wife and me and actually putting distance between my wife and me, and she was not doing well in school, and I was worried about that. I had a bunch of different motives for why I wanted her to do well in school. One was to get off my back. One was to show the teachers that I'm not a bad tutor. I was trying to tutor and she wasn't taking direction from me, but I wanted the teachers not to think I was such a bad parent that I couldn't teach her, help her learn this stuff. I didn't want her to bug me. I there were all kinds of things she was doing that bothered me. So that's the non-so-virtuous. But also, I wanted her to do well. I loved her. I worried about her future. I didn't want her to grow up without an education. You know, all kinds of quite virtuous things just out of my love for her. So there was a mixture. And very often, there's a mixture in our relationships with people and our relationships with the world. Some of my feelings, though, were completely virtuous. But they were my own feeling about what should be going on. And that's what the big book is talking about. So they go on page 61. They say what usually happens. The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. I mean, we can be overly nice to try and have our way, or we can be more demanding to have our way. Many of us, as people pleasers, have learned how to do it in the nice way, not in the more demanding way. But people know exactly what's going on. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he's sure that other people are more to blame, he becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can rest as grab satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Isn't it evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And don't his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Certainly on a personal level, that was true. The more I tried to exert my will with my wife, my kids, my parents, the worse it got, not the better. I mean, they had their own wills. They had their own agendas. They had their own needs and wishes. And it just got worse. And sometimes I retreated. I retreated often from the world. And I know lots of my friends in OA have simply retreated and given up and closeted themselves in a place where nothing can bother them. Nothing. Including love, including, companionship. The world is flat. The life is flat. And I've been in that isolated world where I try not to let the world hurt me too much. That means I can't let the world help me too much either. I just have to be alone. and I'm not open. I'm not capable of loving or being loved at that time. And that has happened to me in the midst of love. In the midst of all kinds of people who loved me, I've cut myself off from people because I couldn't stand not getting my way. And I've isolated myself. So they start to describe this kind of person. And I don't know if this rings a bell with you or not, but it's very important from the big book perspective that you understand, if you're like me, that you want life to go your way. You might say, oh, no, I don't want any more. I'll let life go on. But there, if there's not a part of you, I'd be surprised if you're like me, that there'd be a part of you say, oh, yeah, let life go on. Let them all die. Let them all kill them. I don't care. Oh, and you're just feeling so sorry for yourself that you're, things aren't going your way. Whether you actively try and change things or whether, you just sort of give up completely, isn't there a part of you that wants the world to go your way and despairs of the fact that it's not? That doesn't ring a bell. I would be interested to know. So they start to describe it. It says, our actor is self-centered. Egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. Well, they did in 1939, but I don't think they like to call it egocentric now. He's like the retired businessman who lies about in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining the sad state of the nation. Not a particularly nice person, I guess you would say. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. No, a well-meaning person who worries about things. Politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. People with very fine motives who want the world to be a better world. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him. Probably not a very introspective person who doesn't understand where he or she might be to blame. And the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up, the self-pitying person. I mean, here's a whole spectrum of different kinds of people they're describing as self-centered, egocentric. Whatever our protestations, however much we protest, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pities, or our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. You can see that all the description they've given up to now describes people who can be very virtuous or people who can be not virtuous at all or a mixture of that. All of those people they're describing as selfish. People who want their way. Now, selfish in the dictionary will only mean wanting your way for your own purposes, for your own inner desires or your own needs. I mean, selfish, as we talk about it, and the dictionary definition is really how we talk about it, you're being selfish means it's me, me, me. You want things for yourself. You want more money. You want more of this. You want more of that. But the big book describes people with absolutely virtuous motives being selfish. So that when the big book describes selfishness, it's not describing only the people who want things for themselves. It's describing anyone who wants his or her own way, regardless of the motivations. That's really important to understand because when we get to step four, we're going to be asking ourselves where we're selfish. And if you ask me, where am I selfish in not wanting the Holocaust to have occurred? According to the dictionary definition, I'm not selfish at all. I don't want people to suffer. That's not being selfish according to the dictionary. According to the big book definition, I'm being selfish and I want something to happen that isn't happening and it didn't happen. I want my way rather than God's way, if you will. So that's selfish from the big book definition, but not from the dictionary. It's really important to understand that difference. Big book goes on. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. And certainly my life has been an experience of that. Trying to get my way has never gotten my way. Or if it has, it's been really bad. I just want to read a passage from the AA 12 and 12 in step 4. It is from our twisted relations with family, friends, and society at large that many of us have suffered the most. We've been especially stupid and stubborn about them. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Our egomania digs two disastrous pitfalls. Either we insist upon dominating the people we know, or we depend upon them far too much. If we lean too heavily on people, they'll sooner or later fail us, for they're human too and cannot possibly meet our incessant demands, and this way our insecurity grows and festers. When we habitually try to manipulate others to our own willful desires, they revolt and resist us heavily. Then we develop hurt feelings, a sense of persecution, and a desire to retaliate. As we redouble our efforts at control and continue to fail, our suffering becomes acute and constant. So either we try to dominate or we're too dependent, but either way, people are going to fail us. And then come passages that just hit me. We have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. This is from the AA 12 and 12, not from the big book. We have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. Always we tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide beneath it. And I love that notion because I think that's so true. Either if we can't get to the top, we'll hide down below, at the bottom. But we're never in the middle. And I always think about my previous relationships with women. I mean, how my wife ended up with me, I still to this day, I don't know. Because when I look at the women I was interested in, frankly, they were all people who could see through the nice me to the deep down innermost evil me. And they were the ones who were worthy of my respect and love because they weren't superficial. Now, people who saw down to the evil me, of course, wouldn't be attracted to me. So I ended up being attracted to people who would not be attracted to me. Seemed to be a kind of a self-defeating proposition. But that was always, I was always looking, I was always living a double life, or felt I was living a double life. Now, the big book goes on. It says, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. And they, on page 62, sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And this passage can easily be read as saying, you're saying that I deserved to be assaulted, because somehow I made a decision based on self that allowed me to be assaulted. Absolutely not. The big book couldn't possibly think that or say that. Charlie gives this great example. He says when he was 8 years old, his father beat him black and blue. He said, no 8-year-old child deserves to be beaten black and blue. But if 50 years later, his father, who is now dead, is still beating him black and blue in his mind, clearly he made a decision based on self in the past that has placed him in a position to be hurt. That decision may be, my life is ruined, I'll never be able to live happily again because I was beaten black and blue when I was 8 years old. And if it's that, he's made a decision in the past that brings him to the present time, which means he's still being beaten up by his father 50 years after the event occurred. And that concept is that we continue to allow ourselves be hurt by the past because it didn't go our way. And if the past didn't go our way and we want life to go our way, we can't accept the fact that the past hasn't gone our way. Of course, the past has never gone our way. But we can't accept it. You know, I have a friend who hates a person whom I know well as well. And my friend is a very sane person who can hate and then stop hating. or just continue to hate, but it doesn't affect her life. But if I hated that same person, and I have every reason to have the same feelings that this other person has, if I hated that same person, I would eat over it. My mind would be so clouded. That person did evil and awful things, and there's got to be, I can't afford it. And the big book goes on. It says, our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we couldn't live up to them, even though we would have liked to. If I believed in truth, love, justice, and beauty, how could I hate? Really, when you think about it. But I did believe in truth, love, justice, and beauty, and I did hate. How could I exist this way? Well, the answer is, I wasn't living according to what I believed in. That was my problem. I wanted life to go a certain way according to the dictates of truth, love, justice, and beauty, and when it didn't go that way, I couldn't stand it. not very adult of me, but then, you know, another point in the AA 12 and 12, which Bill Wilson wrote, Bill says the general maturity level of alcoholics has been determined to be at 11 years old. How we hate that, you know, but it's true, and it's true for me. I remember after about 6 months in the program in OA, I spoke at a meeting. I said, I think I'm finally turned 14. You know, I'm on the verge of adulthood now. So this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. In other words, we had to turn our will over. Had to get rid of our will. Next, we decided that here after this drama of life, God was going to be our director. We have to turn our life over. Will, life. The first section talked about will. Now we're talking about life. God was going to be our director. He's the principal. We're his agent. He's the father. We're his children. And the big and the draft said, get that simple relationship straight. I'm very glad they took that sentence out, and I wish they had taken a few of the other sentences out, because they, reading about God, father, principal, agent, children, it's not language that I appreciate. Anyway, so they've spent a whole number of pages discussing the idea of will and life. What does it mean to give up our will? It means we aren't in charge, and we don't try to be in charge. What does it mean to give up our life? It means we will devote our life to doing the will of our higher power. So if you are religious or you have some spiritual notion, it is the notion of following the will of a supreme being of some kind. For me, it's following the notion of supreme ideas or higher passions of mine. But whatever it is trying to live my life according to them, not trying to live my life according to what I want out of life. And here the promise of page 63, at the top of page 63, people often think these are the promises of step 3. They're not. They're the promises of what happens after you've turned your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand God, which doesn't happen in step 3. I'll prove it to you in a few different ways, but the first way I'll prove it to you is just by reading these promises. They're all becoming promises. They're all this begins to happen. When we sincerely took such a position, which means doing steps 4 to 12, I think, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, because we've now, at a certain point, we turn our will and life over to the care of God. We've only made a decision in step 3. We haven't done it yet. Step 4 through 9 will do that for us. So, by the way, we get our job description on page 102. I'll be pointing it out to you. It says, your job now is to be of maximum helpfulness to others. Once we're able, page 102 is past the recovery point. It's past step 9 when we've recovered. Now we're able to do God's will. Now we're able to live a life to be of maximum helpfulness to others. We're not trying to have things go our way. We're trying to have things go God's way, whatever God might mean. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed. If we kept close to him and performed his work well, that's steps 4 through 12. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new life, new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. This is the promise of the program, not the promise of step 3. If you wait for this to happen at step 3, you'll be waiting a very, very long time. And I know people who do wait at step 3, wait for God to come into their lives. And if you read the OA 12 and 12, you might even interpret that essay on the step 3 as meaning that. I don't think it says that, but a lot of people read that essay as saying, wait until God comes into your life until you go on to step 4. But the big book approach is the only way God's going to come into your life is if you get rid of the things that block you from God. The only way you're going to get rid of the things that block you from God is getting honest with yourself, getting honest with another human being, and making amends for the harms that you've done. So these promises are not the promises of step 3, and I'll prove that by looking down on page 63. The only promise made about step 3, which is a prayer, it's a decision and a prayer, it's in 5 lines up from the bottom. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. That's the only promise, that you'll feel some kind of an effect and sometimes a great one. I've felt different effects. Sometimes it was a great one and sometimes it wasn't. But I felt an effect. Making a decision is an important moment in my life to say, yeah, you know, I'm going to try this. I'm really, really going to try it. It's an important and sincere moment. And the prayer that's said here is a very significant prayer. For me, it was doubly significant because I didn't pray. And to say a prayer like this was just against everything that I believed in. Funny enough to say I believed in something that made it a prayer difficult. But I said it anyway because my sponsor told me to do it and I did it. I changed the these and the thous to use, but that was about the only change I made. I don't do that anymore, but I did it then. So let's say the step three prayer. All right, by the way, the manuscript, the draft used to say, get down on your knees and say to your maker. I'm really glad they got rid of that. Although I have said this on my knees at times. Anyway, let's say it. It's on middle of page 63. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. It's a brilliant prayer because, you know, it says, I'm offering myself to God to do what? To build with me, to do with me as you will. I'm in your hands. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? So I won't eat anymore? No. So I can better do your will. Because the more I'm relieved of the bondage of self, the more I can do God's will, not my will. Take away my difficulties. So I won't have any difficulties? No. So victory over them will bear witness to other people of your power, your life, and your way of life. In other words, I am to become a symbol of the value of giving up my will. I'm to help others. And the overcoming of my difficulties is not for my own benefit, but to help others in their quest for spiritual wholeness. That's my job in life now. And what we find out is that even though it takes time and even though it takes a lot of effort, it is one of the most fulfilling things we can do in our lives. And we'll talk about that more tomorrow. The big book says we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. And so this will now, from this moment on, this is now known as the decision. And there will be various points where the big book will talk about the decision, and that's what they mean, saying this prayer. But you notice that's all it is. It's a prayer. It's a decision. It's nothing more. Understand the consequences of it by reading the first few pages that we discussed about wanting to be the director of the play and all that. But it is only a decision. And the big book makes this very clear. Bottom page 63. Next, we launched out in a course of vigorous action. To launch is to propel yourself with vigor from a dock. We didn't start. We launched out. We pushed ourselves away on a course of vigorous action. We haven't done anything yet. We've done a lot of reading. We've made a decision. We've done nothing. Now it's time to take action. And you realize how different this is from some other ways of doing the steps, from how people sometimes just wait at step three for something to happen. Not the big book. It pushes you on and on and on. You got to keep on going or else you'll fall flat on your face. Remember, in step one, we've given up the food. Remember that in step one, we've understood that our mind can play tricks on us and it'll send us back to the food if we don't recover and find a higher power. We're on a race. If we don't finish step nine when we're promised recovery, our mind's going to come back. And so we're in a race with our mind. Can we get recovery before our mind persuades us that it's okay to have something to eat? And I've watched people in this program take their time doing the steps and relapse. And so I look at the big book, and it's so obvious to me how the big book says, keep on going. You got to rush it. You got to go quickly. And how the early people in AA recovered that quickly, too, because it was urgent. If they didn't recover quickly, they'd relapse. That was their history. That was my history. And so that's what I say to people I sponsor. That's what I urge you to think about. No matter how you do the steps, if you languish and delay, you will probably relapse. Or else, you'll be hanging on and you'll be a dry drunk or a white-knuckle abstainer. There are people who are like that. They're the people who come to the meetings and they don't do the steps, but they use the meetings as tools to help them keep from eating. Hey, that's okay. I get, you know, I'm not trying to kick anyone out, but that's not what the meeting is about. The purpose of the meeting is to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps to the person who still suffers, not that we're there for you to give you comfort. The purpose of the meeting is to, tradition five. The primary purpose of every OA meeting is to carry the message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. That's our primary purpose, no other. Okay. So next we launched on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us from the sunlight of the Spirit, from God. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. And therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. So step four is starting upon the inventory, not finishing it. We'll find out that we finish it in step nine. Regardless of what the steps on the wall say, we start upon the inventory in step four. And they start describing what an inventory is. They say a general inventory, a business inventory, a business that which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial business inventory is a fact-finding, searching. To find a fact is to search for it, eh? And fact-facing, fearless. To face facts is to be fearless, a searching and fearless process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. So when you do a commercial inventory, you're looking at all kinds of things. You're looking at the good things, the things that are selling, the things that aren't selling, the things that you have to get rid of, the things that you should keep, the things you need more of, the things you need less of, right? A general commercial inventory is a wholesale, as it were, an all-inclusive process. But the big book isn't talking about that kind of inventory. They say that one object of an inventory, one object of a commercial inventory, is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. That's what we're doing. We're in this inventory only looking at the damaged and unsaleable goods and getting rid of them promptly without regret. We don't have to look at the good stuff. And you will find people will often say, well, the inventory, you put down the good stuff and you put down the bad stuff. And I'll talk about that as we go on as to why a lot of people do that. But from the big book perspective, the object of this inventory is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. We'll learn that second and third and fourth is steps 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. But first, we search out the flaws. Being convinced that self manifested, showing itself in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations, its common symptoms. So we were convinced that self was what had defeated us. We were convinced in the discussion about turning our will over. Our wish to be in charge of life had defeated us. Now we're on to the step for inventory. And for this, there are a number of forms that were three forms that were devised straight out of the big book by an AAer named Blaine D. Used to live in Winnipeg, he now lives north of here. And he counted himself as a student of Joe and Charlie. He was the guy who taught me the big book. And he developed these forms, which I've studied a lot of step four forms, and I've never seen forms that are as close to the big book and as powerful. Having said that, if you have another way of doing step four that works for you, I'm not suggesting you do this. I'm only saying that if you've tried step four and it hasn't given you the results that you want, this might be worth trying. If you're looking to sponsor another person, you may find this is to be a very simple way and fast way of doing step four. But I will simply tell you that I have never found a better way of doing it. And I've read at least dozens, if not, no, I can't say I've read hundreds. I've probably read close to 100 different step four methods. I've never seen anything that's quite as brilliant as this. I want to give you the overview, and then I'll go down more into specifics. This is the overview that I've developed of it. There are three areas that you look at, and you look at them for different reasons. The first thing you do is you have a resentment form. And a resentment has to be understood in a very broad sense. It's not just something you're angry about. It's something that you wish hadn't occurred. It's basically the past didn't go my way. Here are all the things in the past that bother me. Here are all the things in my present life that bother me. This is what bothers me. This is what I resent. It may be I hurt someone else and I think about it all the time, or maybe someone else hurt me and I think about it all the time, or maybe things are going on in life that I don't like. But that's a resentment. And we go through a process, and I'll describe it, in which we gradually move from what bothers us to the part we play in that. And we find out that we have four character defects from that. Only four. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And I'll describe each one of them. I'll talk about each one of them. But there are four of them. So we have only four of them. We don't have 25 or 100 of them. We don't have jealousy, conceit, pettiness, gossiping, the seven deadly sins, lust, and all that. We have four. They are basic, they're deep, and they are part of every single one of the things that are wrong with us. But they are the four. We then have a fear form that deals with the frightened one of our, the one of the four defects of character, the fear part. And this fear form takes us through a process whereby we change from being afraid of something to figuring out how to deal with reasonable concerns that might have caused us fears, and also teach us to distinguish reasonable concerns from unreasonable concerns. And so we begin, as the big book promises us, to outgrow fear by filling out this form. It's really quite magic. So we've already begun to deal with one of our four character defects in the midst of doing step four. The third form is a sex conduct form, and sex conduct has to do with difficult relationships in which there was some physical attraction in that relationship. Sex in 1939 was a far broader concept than it is now. Sex right now has a much more basically a physical aspect to it, but in 1939, sex was a far more general thing, talking about relationships in which there was attraction. And the sex conduct form deals with selfishness, dishonesty, and what they call inconsiderateness, which is the other side of self-seeking. To be a self-seeking person is to think of yourself and not to think of others. If you think of yourself and not of others, you're inconsiderate. So the sex conduct form deals with selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking or inconsiderate, the three leftover defects of character that the fear form didn't deal with, right? You have four defects of character. The fear form dealt with one of them. The sex conduct form deals with the next three, or with the other three. And it gives you guidance. You move from where you've been selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking in relation to relationships where there were where there was physical attraction, difficult relationships, to an understanding of what you should have done instead. You now have guidance as to how you can act in a way that is not selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate in difficult relationships, which should give you guidance in all relationships. It's almost like a dry run for your amends. You begin to see the kind of person you could have been if you look back at your difficult relationships and you begin to understand how you could have done it differently. And so as you work through step four, you're dealing with your fears, and you're examining certain parts of your life in which you've been exhibited those other three defects of characters, and you're understanding how easy it would have been to act differently. That then gives you all the sense in the world of the different person you can become as you work through the rest of steps 4 through 9. I find that absolutely brilliant because it just all fits together. And anyone who uses these forms will see how it fits together. We'll go into more detail with them. But for me, it's just amazing. And I never realized until recently that is how it is constructed. I knew it worked. I didn't know exactly why, but now I see why. Each of the forms has a different object. The first form isolates your defects of character. The second form deals with one of those defects of character in total. The third form deals with three of them in sort of a rehearsal for what you're going to be doing. Because then, because those are the difficult ones when you get to steps 8 and 9, how do you make amends in the relationships you've had with people? So that's how it works. Yes, I can only answer briefly because I'm on the tape. The four defects of character are selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and fear, and frightened. And I'll show them to you as we go. Now, the forms are found in the book, the step four forms are found on page 26, 27, and 28. Or did we make copies of them separately too? Oh, and they're copies separate too. If you go to oabigbook.info, www.oabigbook.info, you'll get forms that you can actually fill out on your computer. You can download them and fill them out on your computer using Adobe Reader. And some people find that very convenient, and some don't, but you can do that. You can either print them up and write on them, or you can fill them in on the computer. Just if you fill them in on your computer, make sure that you save each page as a separate name, or else you'll just, you know, copy over the same page and you only end up with one page. But you know what I mean? Save as? Okay. Now, I'm going to sort of go between the forms and the big book, because I do have some time to be able to go through the big book and talk about it. And I'll show you where the forms are. So let's deal with the resentment form first, if you can have it in front of you and also have the big book in front of you. They say on page 64, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, it took Joe and Charlie to point out what is so obvious now that I look at it. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. So first we made a list before we did anything else. On these forms, your tendency is to go across the page from column 1 to column 2 to column 3 to column 4. But in fact, you go down. You list everything on column 1 before you go on to column 2. And that really is important. So first you make a list of your resentments. Now, what does that mean? Now, it does use the word angry, but I can only tell you it works best if you think about angry in the sense of I'm angry that it's in my mind. You write down a list of anything that bothers you. Anything that's living in your mind rent-free. The what-ifs and the if-onlys of your life. Oh, if only this had never happened, my life would be better. Or what if this had happened? I could have said this to him, you know, or I could have said that. Or if I just made that decision differently, or I, you know, all the what-ifs and if-onlys. All the things that bother you about the past and the present, and maybe the future. I've written down things as silly as the guy who cut me off this morning when I was turning a corner. To the Holocaust and Hitler. I mean, there's a pretty wide range from the ridiculous to the truly tragic and horrible. I've written down ex-girlfriends. I've written down, of course, my wife, my mother, my father, my kids, my brother, my sister-in-law. I've written all kinds. People I don't like, people who don't like me, lawyers I've had difficulties with, clients I've had difficulties with, talk show hosts, particular ones and general ones, politicians, and I won't tell you which ones. I don't talk politics here, but you know, I've written down all kinds of things. And in my first, I had 20, 30 pages, and you just list them. They say people, institutions, or principles. Well, people are people. You write down any people who bother you, whether it's someone who's done harm to you or to others. Or whether it's someone you've done harm to, or people you just feel sorry for, or people you feel angry at, or people who bother you, or people who are hypocritical, any kind of people. What's an institution? It's a group of people that doesn't have a that has a name as a group, but not as individuals. So I wrote down particular talk show hosts, but I also wrote down talk show hosts in general. At a certain point in my life, I don't write them down now, but at a certain point in my life, because sort of there were specific ones who really, really ground me, and the fact that they existed in general bothered me too. So I wrote down both of them. I wrote down the justice system because, as a lawyer, I have learned to have a great deal of cynicism about justice. I wrote down Hitler. I wrote down the Holocaust. I wrote down a bunch, as I said, ex-girlfriends and relatives and stuff like that. What is a principle? I've thought long and hard about that because the big book doesn't give us an example. And it seems to me a principle is a statement about something that bothers you. And it can be as general as life sucks and then you die, you know, to I'll never get ahead in life. I'll always be fat. I'll never lose weight. No one loves me. So it can be sort of general principles. The poor you will always have with you, which has always been a principle that has troubled me. There will always be torture in the world, or there is torture in the world. People are killing each other for no reason. You know, I mean, something as deep as that, which is a principle. It's a concept. It's an idea that bothers me. Or it can be like, I'm a failure. I don't think I'll ever succeed. Life doesn't go my way. Okay? You don't write yourself down. Big Book never talks about putting yourself down in resentment lists, but you can write things, and I have written things about myself that bother me. Okay? Now, in column two, which we'll read in a minute, in column two, we may be filling out a lot, especially for people with whom we're close. So when my wife is on the list, you'll notice on the form there are three boxes in column one. I'm resentful at, and we've got in column one, and there are three boxes for you to write these things down. Now, if my wife, in the early days at any rate, was going to be on my list, then I would usually just write her in the first box and not write anything in the second or third box, because I knew that when it came to column two, I'd be writing a lot more than the space that they give me on this form, or my mother or my father when I first filled this out. On the other hand, for the guy who cut me off, I could put him down, and I could put down my grade three teacher. Well, I love my grade three teacher, but you know what I'm saying. I could put down a teacher who bothered me, and I could put down, you know, a friend of mine in grade five who called me fat or something like that. Because I know I wouldn't have to fill out too much in column two about that. Does that make sense to you? That's pretty clear, right? So you just make your list. And I found it to be very convenient to make that list in an evening and then wake up in the morning, and I'll usually think of a few things that I didn't think of the night before. And it's just as simple as that. How long is it going to take you to write down, even if you have 180, as someone I once did a step five with, had 60 pages of resentments, three on a page. That's 180. But how long is it going to take you to write down 180 resentments if you write them down just, you know, my wife, Hitler, you know, I'll never get skinny or whatever. You know, I mean, how long does it take? It doesn't take you very long. And you're not deeply analyzing anything. You're just writing down what's on your mind. I'll give an example. I've had friends in this program who have suffered tremendous sexual assaults in their lives. And they've been through, some of them have been through tremendously helpful and powerful counseling and psychological therapy, where they've completely dealt with it. And they said, should I write it down? I don't think about it anymore. I said, why should you write anything down that you've completely dealt with? Oh, maybe I should. Why do anything unless it's bothering you now? You're writing down what's bothering you now, not what bothered you or what you think should be bothering you. I mean, there are times when I listen to a step five and I think, why the hell haven't they written this down? But they haven't, so I don't say anything about it. Because it's up to them to write down what's on their mind. So you just write down what's on your mind. Not a lot of thinking to be done here. Not a lot of introspection. No great deep psychological insights here. You're just putting onto paper what's on your mind. Those of you who have filled out these forms, I'm sure will agree with me, that once you do that, you get a little bit calmer. Because you're no longer juggling a whole bunch of ideas that come in and out of your consciousness. They're down on paper, and you can sort of begin not to forget them, begin to rely on the fact that they're there, and they're not sort of like, so there is a calming influence. It's really nice to put them down. Sometimes, rarely, but sometimes you'll put something down and say, oh, how stupid, that's on my mind, and it's already dealt with, you know. But very often it's not. It's not dealt with, especially if this is the first time you've ever done it. These things are there, and they're serious, and they're important. And they're killing you, as you'll find out. Okay, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. And again, I encourage you to read that as being angry that they're on my mind. Not angry at them, but angry that they're on my mind, or resenting that they're on my mind. Be broad. Write it all down. It's really helpful. Okay?